nanohub.org.
You can follow along with this presentation using printed slides from the NanoHub. Visit www.nanohub.org and download the PDF file containing the slides for this presentation. Print them out and turn each page when you hear the following sound. Enjoy the show.
So let's go on to the next set of notes. What we want to do in order to understand this is I'm going to approach this from what's called an introductory level of theory. There's lots of complications in high-resolution theory, and I'm able to do introductory level, and then beyond that, it's beyond me. All right, there's some people that are pretty. There's lots of levels into this. We'll go through and talk about it from an introductory level so that we get a sense of how this all works. And in particular, we're going to learn about something called the contrast transfer function. That's the primary way that we interpret the combined effects of spherical aberration and defocus. We'll also understand how other things can interfere with this, how coherence in the beam, how shaking of the sample, shaking of the room, whatever, can reduce resolution. Those are called envelope functions. And then we're going to go through and at the end and talk about a couple of more advanced ideas just so that you see them. If we had much more time, we could get into these in some detail, but we're just going to overview them so that you're aware of them. So really the goal is to develop this introductory level theory. And then after we have that theory, the next class is going to be implementing that theory into a program mode where you can simulate images, right, so that you can match the images you obtain with simulations and understand them better. So you have to understand the theory first, and then we'll describe how the simulations work. Okay? All right. So the unfortunate thing is that all of the kind of mathematical modes that we've been talking about throughout the semester, where we've been doing lots of these sums, over interatomic potentials and things like that, in high-resolution theory, people tend to use a slightly different mathematical approach, and so we're going to use the one that everyone else uses so that you see it, so that you're familiar with it, when you also look at books and you have reason to see this stuff. But what that means is we're going to be kind of reframing some of the same concepts with different terms and different variables, and I apologize, but that's the way it is, okay? All right, so the general idea is what we want to do is we want to try to understand how to take something that's a point in the object, like an atom, right, and understand how the objective lens acts on that point to give a blurred image of that point from the spherical aberration and defocus effects. Okay? Right. So if we had perfect lenses, we would take the point and we would take a picture of the point that was a point. But the problem is the presence of the spherical aberration takes points in our object and causes them to be blurred in the image. Okay? The lack of perfection in the lenses is the origin of why we have to go through all this. All right. So what we're going to do is we're going to go through and say we've got some function that describes the atomic positions in our object. And we're just going to call that f of r prime. Okay? We've been calling that v of r primes as atom locations, right, before. But now we're just going to make it more general and say that I want to take some way of describing the thing that I want to image, my object, and I'm just going to describe it as a function over positions in real space, r prime. And then what I want to do is I want to go ahead and do a convolution of that with something called a blurring function. And my arrow's off there. But the blurring function is trying to take into account all the problems I have with imaging caused by the spherical aberration, the defocus, the envelope functions, and all of that. Okay? And what we get out of that is we get then an image that is what we want to see times the blur. In other words, if we think about it, when I take my glasses off, right, what I see is I see a room full of you all convoluted with a blurring function, right, because I've got terrible eyes. And so the role of my glasses is to get rid of H of R so that I take a simple image of the objects, all right? But I instead have a terrible blurring function. It's different in each eye, different glasses, And the result then is I have these things to get rid of the blur, right, to correct for that so that I see the real object that's there. In TEM world, that would be my 1.25 million, right, for my spherical aberration corrector so that the object that I'm looking at is directly replicated in the image, okay? So mathematically, f of r is the thing we're trying to take a picture of. H of r is all the problems we have grouped together. And then what we do to get the answer is we get a g of r that's equal to the integral over all of the space, right, of f of r convoluted with h of r. Now, who's heard the term convolution? Okay, we have one mechanical engineer. They tend to have more math, okay? What a convolution does is it takes one function that looks, you know, let's pick some function like a top hat type function. And then there's another function. So if this is, say, h of r and that's f of r, then g of r is basically taking and putting and superimposing h of r over f of r like this, and then looking at this area and this area and this area as you go through and do this. And what you end up with is you end up creating an additional looking function that's caused by the overlap of this and that. It's just called a convolution mathematically. So go through and look at that. The reason that we do that is that that's the correct thing theoretically to deal with, and we're going to want to go through and look at that, okay, and understand how that all works. So the idea then is what I want to do for the rest of the lectures on this theory is I want to understand how to formulate f of r, how to formulate h of r, and how to mathematically go through and solve for the g of r. Okay, so we need to have a new way of expressing the periodic potential. That's f of r. We need to have a new or a completely new understanding of all of the elements of the aberration function h of r, and then how that comes through and gives us the image g of r. Okay, so that's where we'll go next time. We had an overview that was a discussion of the general idea of high-resolution microscopy, right? And you recall that the general idea is that we think about the sample as being something that causes diffraction, right? The wave comes in with a single-valued wave vector, and the result of its interaction with the sample is that you have the creation of a number of diffracted beams, and those diffracted beams interact with the transmitted beam, and all of these interactions give you areas of constructive and destructive interference, and so the image that you see, right, is to first order a result of that phenomena in the sample. But then we also commented that the microscope has its own issues, namely that spherical aberration acts in a complicated way as a function of defocus to cause different scrambling of the phase information in the different diffracted waves. And so in order to understand how to interpret our images, we have to first develop a method to understand the diffraction event, which we've done already, right? We have a pretty good feel for that. That's the reason that I've put so much emphasis on it in the class. And then the second thing we need to do is have a way to deal with the microscope and how it affects the images. So again, kind of philosophically, you know, almost half of this class we just dealt with diffraction, right? And then from there we build on diffraction contrast and now high resolution imaging. And that's because you have to understand the diffraction first, because that's what gives us, in the case of the diffracted contrast images, is what gives us the difference between scattering between the zero and the G beam. And in this case, it's the diffraction events that cause the different phase shifts between the different beams that we're interested in, okay? So once we have that, now we need to go through and think about how to understand how these things phase interfere to give us the high-resolution image. The general idea is that we're going to go through and kind of reformulate essentially the theory of the scattering event so that we have a different kind of way to imagine the sample. We know that what we want to see in the end is the exit wave as it leaves the sample, right? And then from that, that exit wave will tell us what the scattering potentials must have been within the sample. So what we need to do is first have a way of describing the sample and its scattering potentials, right, so that we can use that as the first phase of creating an idea of what the image should look like. And then we're going to have to deal with the microscope section on top of that next, okay? So the idea is that we want to go through and look at the microscope in a really simple way by just simply thinking of, okay, if I've got some point in my object, then what does the microscope do to that point in terms of giving me an image? If we had a perfect lens, the goal of the objective lens would be to do nothing more than magnify that object and give me a perfect rendering of a point in my object plane to a point in my image plane. But the presence of spherical aberration in particular, other aberrations that we'll learn about, causes there to be a blurring of the point from the object space into a disk in the image plane. And so what we need to do is understand, again, how to describe that blurring, what things are encompassed in that blurring, so that we can go from our image, the thing that we have is an image, and return to an ideal object, which is essentially the exit wave as it leaves the crystal. Okay? So, again, the goal, try to understand where the atoms are. The thing that happens physically in the sample is diffraction. The interference between the transmitted and diffracted waves gives us this exit wave, which carries that information of interest, the scattering and the location of the atoms within the sample. Unfortunately, we have problems with aberration, so we have to understand how to go from what we collect, an image, back to an exit wave, and then from that, the scattering potential. Okay? So within the framework of how we want to develop the theory, what we need to do is have a way to describe the object mathematically, have a way to describe the action of the objective lens, again, mathematically, and then finally what we're going to want to do is look at how these things interact to give us the image that we see. If we take our object and consider it as just some function where we have some scattering potentials located in a plane, for example, with different strength, and these are located in the plane by some random vector r with respect to an origin, then this thing, f of r, would be a way to describe where the atoms are mathematically. The other thing that we know is that if we have this problem with aberration, we need to find a way to take care of and understand how mathematically it affects the image that we obtain. It's known from optics that the correct way to deal with the presence of these aberrations is to go through and use what's called a convolution. That's a mathematical type of operation that takes the thing that is our object and operates on it with another mathematical function to describe how the aberrations are interacting, and then gives us an answer out the other side, which is the image. And again, this is all done within real space, taking us from an object to an image through a convolution of this so-called blurring function. Okay? Now, as we saw, it's also reasonable to talk about the description of our entire system by looking in reciprocal space, right? We said that we can take our real space object, which has atom positions described on a lattice, and create a reciprocal lattice. And it's an equally valid description of our scattering potentials, right? It's just a different coordinate choice. We can do that, and then we can also operate all of these things in reciprocal space, where we then say we have some object, which is now described in reciprocal space, and then we have the action of our blurring function, again, described in reciprocal space. And then this gives us an image, which is a reciprocal space information, and then we can then go back and convert that back into real space. And the reason to do this is that the mathematics are such that it's simpler. And so we'll show you how that works and why. To motivate that further, you'll recall my favorite diagram here, right? The one that says, here's the way that everything really works in terms of the wave function of the electron, right? We said that the scattered wave is something that's described by this overall expression, which in the end encompassed the scattering potentials at each point, right? In other words, all the atom locations within our lattice, right? And we found out that we can describe this in a shorter fashion by discussing this as a first, this overall thing as the combination of shape factor and structure factor. That's what's embedded within this scattered wave here. But again, we also found out that if we looked at this mathematically, the scattered wave that we see was essentially nothing more than a Fourier transform of the scattering potential of where the atoms are located. And so what this means is that if we have in real space atomic positions, then the scattered wave that we find has a Fourier transform relationship to those atomic positions. And so mathematically, this is an operative mode of mathematics we'll use throughout all of this, is using transformations in real space and reciprocal space, and using Fourier transforms as a way to talk back and forth between those two spaces. So that's the way that the mathematics is going to work. And again, it comes about from the very fundamental point that the scattered wave is directly related to the scattering potentials by this Fourier transform. Okay, so that's where the mathematics for all this will come. Okay, so here's how this theory goes. The first thing that we want to do is we want to go through and we want to describe our scattering potential, right? We want to understand how to do these things in both real space and in reciprocal space. We want to go through and talk about a real space model and a reciprocal space model of our object plane information, a way to understand the objective lens function, both in terms of real space and reciprocal space, and a way to look at our image plane, both in terms of real space and reciprocal space. The back focal plane of the objective lens is where the reciprocal space information is contained in the microscope after the wave comes through the sample and is imaged by the objective lens. And so in the back focal plane, where you see your diffraction pattern, that is the reciprocal space answer, right, to how the wave scatters with the sample and is imaged with the objective lens. So we can go through and again say if we have some real space image, it is related to the reciprocal space information, again, by a standard Fourier transform type of method. And so again, what we're going to be doing is just switching back and forth between real space and reciprocal space using these Fourier transforms back and forth. The way that the theory will develop, and I'll show you the overall view in the next slide, is that we want to go through and describe either a real space function for the object, for the blurring function, or a reciprocal space description for either the object or the blurring function. And then what we're going to do is instead of using a convolution, which is a more complicated mathematical approach, it turns out that the convolution between these two functions in real space is equal to the multiplication of these two functions here in reciprocal space. That's just a mathematical fact, and it's one that's much more simple to deal with, right? Your computational methods that you use are much faster if you do all this in reciprocal space so that all you're doing is multiplying these functions out as opposed to convoluting them throughout the whole thing, okay? So that's the way that this will follow out. So what I want to do over the next bit is describe how we come about with some method for creating a scattering potential in real space, what assumptions we need to do, how to go about and describe our blurring function in either real or reciprocal space, and then to go through and see how we can then get an image in the back focal plane that is then transformed to an image in real space by a Fourier transform, and use all these things in kind of a logical sequence to get back at where the atoms are. Okay, that's the idea. All right. So this is all theoretical today, and I want to go through the theory part of this to try to explain it. And then the next thing that we'll do is we'll go through and describe how one puts all of this theory into a computer model so that what you can do is tell a computer model, this is the sample that I'm looking at, these are the atoms and where they are, have that computer model make a F of R, right, which is a description of the scattering potentials that interact with the incident electron wave, have that computer model make a blurring function, multiply the blurring function and the reciprocal, the reciprocal information, the blurring function and the reciprocal information on our object to give us, again, an answer out on the other side. So all of these things are first just going to be developed mathematically so that we can put them in the right framework for making a computer simulation. Okay? When I showed you the overview kind of how high resolution works, I showed you examples of the types of images you see and the fact that you always see them when done properly with a simulation embedded, right? And that simulation that's embedded in that is computed in this manner, right? So that what you end up doing is saying, I've got an image, my image looks like this because I've understood, right, what the effects of the blurring function are and gotten back to where the atoms are, okay? So that's the reason to do all this is because the proper way to get back at where the atoms are is to have a good description of how the objective lens fools with the different phases and gives you different information depending on your defocus value. Okay? All right. That's a lot of overview on it. Patrick? Okay? Robert? Okay? All right. So here's what we'll do is first I'm going to go through and describe the object plane function and the assumptions that are embedded within it. All right? Okay. So unfortunately, the mathematics are all different from everything else we've done. Okay? So in the previous modes, right, we set up V of R's, for example, and then went through and solved for the diffraction events that way, and you got all that figured out. Well, we're going to throw all that away, unfortunately, because that's the way this theory developed, and it's also the way that this theory is implemented within the simulation programs. Okay? So it's just a different description of the events using different methods. So I apologize, but there's no way around that in terms of understanding what's going on. Okay? So instead, what we want to do is we're going to say, hey, we've got some specimen. It exists as a location of atoms. We're going to go through and take and essentially squash that specimen down into a plane in X and Y. Okay? In the computer, we're going to learn how that squashing happens. It actually happens in a series of multiple slices through the sample. Okay? But as far as it goes, what we want to do in terms of understanding the theory is ignore the Z dimension along the electron beam and say, I've got some thickness of sample and I've got scattering potentials, right? And I'm going to figure out a way to squash it in the plane of the sample so that the wave comes in, sees atomic locations, scatters from them, and gives me phases out between the transmitted and the different diffracted waves, okay? So that's just the first way that this is done. And again, computationally, when we get this squashed f of xy, it's done in a series of steps, it's logical, and it's accurate enough, okay? But for now, all we're going to say is we've got something that is describing our sample as being a function that has amplitudes at places and phases at places, okay? Because that's, again, kind of a wave-like description of our sample and one that's kind of like the wave-like description we've been using for the electrons as it comes in and interacts, okay? So that's how this is put together, is you say you've got some function of x and y in the plane, an amplitude at each point, and a phase term at each point, okay? What you do in the overall way of developing the theory forward is you just ignore that amplitude phase by normalizing with respect to that equal to 1. In other words, wherever you have a maximum potential, you call that 1, and things fade off from there, okay? What happens is that as the wave comes in and sees this ideal sample, it's going to undergo some phase change due to interacting with the atomic potentials that are there through an integrated thickness, right? So we've squashed it down into a plane in X and Y, but we deal with the squashing part, right, by saying if it's some thickness as I squashed down, then there's a given amount of scattering over that thickness. Okay? That's just a way of looking at this. Again, in the model, in the computational model, you take multiple unit cells that exist in the sample, and you do this through sections so that you squash phase changes over small sections within the overall sample. Okay? Okay. So now wave comes in, you have locations of scattering, and then you compute a phase change that's an integration of those locations of scattering through the thickness of the sample. And again, it's a lot like saying my electron comes in, it goes through as a transmitted beam or a series of diffracted beams, and each of those diffracted beams undergo phase shifts that are appropriate for the scattering potentials located along each direction in the crystal. It's an equivalent way of doing it. It's just a different mathematics. Okay? Comfortable? Anyone not comfortable? Okay. All right. So this then says that if my beam comes in at some phase, and then it's going to undergo phase shifts as it interacts with the scattering potentials that are there. And these phase shifts depend on what scattering potential is located where at X and Y. And we end up having a beam that came in and then underwent series of phase shifts as a result of interacting with the atoms that are there. Okay? Okay. The way that we do this is we make there's a couple of phrases that are used here. The idea is that what we just created, right, is some way of looking at how the electron that's incident to the sample is affected by the atomic potentials to give phase shifts. And so what this thing is really doing is taking and acting like a phase grating to the incident electron wave. So if you have some optics background, or you've just, you know, you've seen this before, right? The idea of a phase grating is that you take a wave in and you get a number of changes in phase depending on the phase grating that you're using. So this is something that's going to be called a specimen transfer function, all right? And this is really what we're doing is we're saying, hey, this is what we see at the end. The wave looks like this interaction of my incident wave with my specimen transfer function, and what comes out the other side is the exit wave, which is the thing I want to know because that's telling me back again where the potentials sit, okay? So the action of the sample is to simply cause these phase shifts, and then we're going to relate those back to where the atoms are, okay? And so the thing that we're going to do is look at this, and really we're going to want to try to find out what this looks like, because that's the thing that we're going to relate back to where the atom positions are, all right? In the overall theory, you can include things like absorption if your sample's very thick, but in high-resolution theory, people always ignore absorption and use what's called a weak phase object approximation. And this says that the sample is very, very thin, the absorption's negligible, the strength of these potentials is small with respect to one, and so what you do is you can then say, I've got F of XY equal to this exponential of minus I sigma, the location of the potentials in X and Y, you truncate, kill off that absorption, and then you use a mathematical expansion for the exponential and neglect higher order terms, and we end up with a more simple description of the phase change that the electron undergoes when interacting with the atomic positions. So we took a more complex wave-type motion and had now a simpler form of it based on having a very weak interaction of the electrons with the sample. This is a key approximation. It's equivalent to our kinematical approximation that we used in diffraction. In diffraction, right, we said if we have very low scattering probability because our sample is so thin, most of the electrons in the direct beam and very little has been diffracted out. Same way here, we're saying that as we have a sample that's very, very thin, it's going to undergo, the wave's going to undergo some phase shift due to the presence of the atoms that are there, but it's a weak phase shift because the sample's relatively thin. Okay? So, mathematically, that's an assumption. Practically, it's also a reality. It means that if we're going to use any of the theory that we develop to describe our sample, right, if we take a picture, do a simulation, and our sample is very, very thick, then this theory will break down. So what this means is that practically in the microscope, you need to be doing high-resolution imaging on very, very thin sample regions. Typical sample thicknesses are on the order of 100 angstroms, at most 200 angstroms, And that's then a firm restriction on doing good, careful, high-resolution work that you can interpret. You can find and observe phase contrast, high-resolution images in thicker samples, right? It's not anything that can't happen, but the problem is when we go beyond this weak phase description, the theories we've developed, and then importantly, the computer simulations that are based on those theories break down, and you don't have good matches between the simulations that you embed in the little corner of your image, right, and the actual image you see, okay? So the weak phase object approximation is one that's actually very, very important in high-resolution microscopy, both because it tells us what we can do practically in the microscope, right, how thick can our sample be practically to be useful, and it's also the primary one that we use when developing the simulation methods that we're dealing with, okay? Okay. So this little section that I just went through is just the development of some theory, the ideas of saying we've got some ideal specimen, it causes phase changes in the electron wave, and the only real reason I wanted to show you this was to show you that in the end, you have to make this approximation that the sample is very thin to develop this particular description, which is the one that all of these simulation packages use. Okay? That was the origin of this. So now what we've done is we've got ourselves a model of the sample, right? Our sample, we'll talk about how we create from, you know, diamond cubic or, you know, tin oxide, how we get a model that looks like this. But this mathematically is the model that we're dealing with of the sample for the rest of things, okay? So what this does then is this is now my real space object describing not a point now in object space, but rather the scattering potential in 2D that the electron wave comes in and sees, okay? Okay, so again, returning to this same view graph, now I have F of R in real space. We want to go through and talk about how to understand what goes in the H of R, the blurring function, so that we can then find out the image that we get. Okay? So we've done the first part of this, which is to describe the object, and again, the key approximation being that it's thin enough that very small phase shifts are the ones that are introduced. Okay? Yes, sir? 10. Yeah, 10 or 15. Right, so if it's, I mean, okay, 20 maybe, right? I mean, preferably you want it to be as thin as it can possibly be. And at 100 angstroms, right, you're at 20 atom layer thickness in FCC-ish materials, metals. So really, 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 really thin. Practically, the way that you do high-resolution work is you make your sample, right, you tilt to zone axis, and then you continue to tilt in real space, looking at your image and taking the bend contours, right, and driving them right to the thinnest edge of the sample where you want to look, okay? And it gets hard because as you tilt, of course, that sample's very, very thin, and it's bending, and of course, as you tilt, it bends more and bends more as the gravity changes on it, so it's a bear, polite English, right? But this is part of what you have to do is get yourself right on the zone axis in the very thinnest region, very thinnest region. So 20 atom layer thicknesses. One of the things that's nice, if you have access to a high voltage microscope, then the weak phase object approximation lets you go to about 300 angstroms. All right, and so I used to run work a lot on the ARM out at Berkeley because I was lazy. Right, it was great. The samples could be thicker. I didn't have to work so hard in sample preparation, and the images were still good because you could look through a thicker section. That's a nice advantage to it. It really is. Okay, but when you deal with a 200 kV or 300 kV machine, it's very, very thin. Okay. Just, again, practically, that makes things hard, right? Because if you're trying to study a particular interface or defect, you have to have made your sample so that that interface and that defect is very, very thin, right where you want to look at it. It can complicate things where you do not have statistics in your favor, right? If you're looking at some phenomena where you have various orientations between a film and a substrate, right? then you just keep ion milling until you finally get one of them in the thinnest region. So you just keep going back and forth through the microscope until the grain orientation you want is one that's right in the thinnest region. Okay. So I once did a study with some folks at IBM where they wanted to look at nickel silicide textures on silicon. And the only reason I got involved in that study is because it was just easier to do it on the ARM. Because you could go to a thicker region and have more possible statistics of finding one that was oriented right. So, because it's just if you do not have it in the thin region all the time, you got to wait until you do. If you're trying to look at a dislocation core, for example, right? So if you want to understand the structure around a defect, a dislocation, you got to have a whole lot of them, right? In order for those to have some statistical chance of being in the thinnest region around. And so studies of dislocations in semiconductor materials can be very, very difficult because you do not have very good ways of creating 10 to the 12 densities of defects in silicon. I mean, that's not very easy to do. So it's just another thing out there. Okay. So very, very thin, right at the edge of the sample, the area you're interested in. So that's, you see, you know, this little thing I just did with this whole little derivation of weak phase object approximation, that's the point. Is that it's got to be really, 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 really thin. Okay? Okay. I'm not a theoretician. I'm practical. Okay? All right. So now we've gone through and described f of r. We want to go through and describe h of r, the blurring function. Okay? And understand the parts that are within that. John, you still have questions?
No.
No. Okay. Still thinking. Okay. All right. Very thin. Yeah. So very thin. Yeah. Really thin. Yeah. 20 atom layers is really thin. Okay. Okay, so we've just then done this. We've described our object plane, and what we want to do next, right, is describe a mathematical function for all the things that the objective lens does badly for us. All right? And there's other things too, not just the objective lens, but that's the primary one we'll worry about, and we'll talk about some other ones too. Okay? So if we take this, right, we have now a description of our sample, f of r, or f of x and y, and we're convoluting it with h of x and y, our blurring function. That is giving us our scattered wave, our exit wave, the thing that we want to see. Okay? Right. So in other words, going back to this, if we have this and this, this blurs that and gives us an image of the scattered wave. Okay? Now, what we do in order to do this is we just go through and say, let's just again call this some general wave. And instead of calling it an exponential one, like we did last time, remember we said f of r was just some random wave exponential with some scattering potentials in it. Now instead we're going to say it's another form of the exponential, cosine plus I sine, right? That's another way of describing a wave. Remember, everyone remembers that, right? Okay. Okay. And so we'll just go through and say that's the answer, and then we'll learn what terms are in that. Okay? So we're going to go through and look at this and say now our wave function is the f of r convoluted with our h of x, y. I have gone through and I'm trying to remember why my pluses and minuses are there. Don't worry about it. We're going to end up saying, though, that we take this thing, right? We can go through and multiply out. The minus signs come through. In the end, what we do is we take our wave function and we create an intensity with it. We do that by taking the wave function, multiplying it by its complex conjugate. That's the standard way to move from an electron wave function to an intensity, collapse it down into an intensity, and this is then what we get. We have f of r with an extra 2 showing up, convoluted with now just the sine of xy term. And so what this is as we've gone from a general wave and interacted with this convolution function to get a wave function, we create an intensity, and this term here, this sine of xy, is now the thing that's representing all of the blurring that's going on within that. All right? So we want to understand this particular function, sine of xy, and capture all the important things in that. Okay? So again, just it's a development of the theory. Take f of r, convoluted it with h of r. Here's some description of h of r. Go through and do a little math. What you find is that the intensity of the electron exit wave is equal to more or less f of r. There's a factor of 2 in there now, convoluted with the sine function that's describing the blurring. So let's go through and look at that sine function. Okay? That sine function is now H of R in real space. It can be converted to capital H of U in reciprocal space just by going through and doing the mathematical operations from real to reciprocal. And so what we want to do is look at that H of U, which is called the objective lens transfer function, and understand the terms that are embedded within it. To first order, there are three. There's one associated with the size of the aperture that's used, another associated with the coherence of the electron wave coming into the sample, which is something that Jeremy asked about the other day, right? I recall now. Or was it Lior? Okay, I knew it was one of you guys in the corner, right? So that's one of the things we have to worry about is as we bring the wave in, I'm claiming it's single-valued, right, in its energy, but of course it's not quite, and that can cause some problems. And then the final one is the aberration function. So what I want to go through to do is describe each of these three terms. They multiply by each other in reciprocal space to give us the overall aberration function. The aperture function is determined by the size of the objective aperture. Okay, what's this doing? The objective aperture, as we stick it in the back focal plane, acts to limit what rays contribute to the image, right? And so what it's doing is if we have no objective aperture, the transmitted and all the diffracted waves we can collect act together to form the image that we see. If we instead stick in a relatively big aperture, we collect most of them. If the aperture is smaller, we collect fewer of them. And so what this does is it essentially acts to truncate which waves contribute to the image. That's its role, okay? Very simple one in the end. In most cases, when people do very high resolution work, they skip the objective aperture. They just don't put it in, okay? But you still have an inherent aperture, and that's because if you look, right, there's a tube that runs down the microscope that holds the vacuum, and you do not collect rays out to 179.9 degrees. They get truncated by just the size of the microscope tube itself. So there's always some aperture within the sample, and what it's doing is limiting which rays contribute to the image, the transmitted and the different diffracted rays. Okay? So that's one of the things we have to consider. In other words, if I look at my image and I see some phase contrast image with white dots and black areas associated with the interference between a transmitted and diffracted beam, if I put in different objective apertures, right, and gradually truncate which beams are contributing, that phase information will change because I'm no longer having a number of these beams contribute to what I see. Okay? So that's one of the things that you can use or need to understand in terms of what limits or affects what you see in the phase image. Yes?
So you have an optimal size of aperture, or is that one of the...
Generally, you just don't bother with one. Okay? Sometimes people will use the largest one because it's round, and it's guaranteed to be round, which is nice because then all of these things are truncated at the same length in reciprocal space. Okay? All of this stuff, follow through, trust me, follow through all these things. We'll go back and talk about them after you've seen through them once, and it does help, okay? I'm also going to see it on the microscope. Okay, just so keep going with me. Generally, people don't bother with one or use the largest, okay? So that's one term, is just what are you truncating with an aperture, okay? This is the most important one, which is the aberration function. And what it does is generally when developing the first order theories, you consider only the effect of spherical aberration, third order spherical aberration, and defocus. If you are doing ultra, ultra high resolution and working with very fancy microscopes with all sorts of aberration correctors, this theory has been extended and extended to incorporate higher order terms. If you're ever interested, I can get you articles on that. But for now, we're going to consider third order spherical aberration and defocus. Okay? So here's the answer for that function. If you have some point in an object, the act of spherical aberration blurs it into a disk of some size in your image. That's what I said all along, right? If you have off-axis rays getting focused more strongly than on-axis rays, The result is a point in your object gets blurred to a disk in your image. Okay? Okay. And the answer for that, as a function of angle, is this. It's C sub S, the spherical aberration coefficient, angle to the third, plus defocus angle. Okay? This is just the answer. You can go through and work through some mathematics. I'm going to skip them. Okay? And I'm going to give you the final answer, which is how the phase shift is affected by this for the electron wave. And this is the answer. And this thing is called chi of u, the aberration function. And if you look, it's a pretty complicated looking function, right? It has 1 half pi c sub s lambda the wavelength to the third, right? U is the distance in reciprocal space away from the optic axis. We'll look at that further. Plus pi delta f lambda u squared, okay? So look at that. A very complicated function, chi of u, all right? All right, so let's go through and look at this and understand how it acts as a function of cs and delta f, all right? Because the operational parameters for a microscope are you have a microscope that has a given cs. You bought it. It's 2.0 millimeter, or it's 1.0 millimeter, okay? So that's the thing that you have when you buy your microscope is the spherical aberration that comes with the microscope. And the thing that you vary is the focus, right, as you go through and look at your sample. You'll recall that in that diagram where I showed you the spherical aberration kind of way that this works, right, if you change the defocus, then you should expect to have changes in where the crossover of different beams away from the optic axis happens. Remember that, right? If you have a deeper defocus underneath the lens, right, then these things are being focused further away from the lens, and the spherical aberration blurring is going to be different than if you bring it close. And again, the question was, well, why don't you just make a really short focal length? And the answer is you do, right? Okay? All right. So that's, again, depends on the defocus. And so this function, chi of u, is the important one because we have fixed CS for a microscope, and what we vary is delta F, okay? Okay. So this is in reciprocal space, right, because it's with this term u. Now, again, why do we do all this? Well, in real space, right, we said that we have f of r convoluted with h of r, f of r being the 1 plus 2 sigma, blah, 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 and the h of r being the thing after the convolution sign, the sine of chi, sine of x and y, okay? What happens is we're going to go through and talk about these things in terms of equivalencies in reciprocal space. We have h of u now having an aberration, the aberration function, the sine chi of u, that's b of u. We have the aperture function. We have this coherence function. I haven't talked about it yet, but I will later. It's easier to talk about it after we've gone through this. But now this is all in reciprocal space as a way of dealing with the blurring of the image by the microscope, okay? So our image then, right, is equal to the blurring function times the reciprocal space of the scattering potential, okay? Okay, so let's go through and then look at this term here and plot it out a bit. What this term does, all of these things, the aperture function, the coherence function, and this sine chi of u, are essentially taking things that are a given distance away from the optical axis in reciprocal space and causing them to undergo different phase shifts, right? So again, my beam comes in, transmitted, diffracted beams. The diffracted beams have inherent phase shifts that are different than the transmitted beam because of the fact that they have different scattering potentials in different directions, okay? The action of the lens is to induce additional phase shifts to the off-axis beams because of the combination of the spherical and defocus, okay? All right, so what this thing is doing is in real space, it's changing phases. In reciprocal space, what this thing is doing is taking the spatial frequencies that are present in the real image and modifying them, okay? Okay, watch this. So if we had an ideal lens it would pass all of the frequencies of the diffracted beams unchanged, right? If our lens wasn't doing this thing where we had poor aberration, spherical aberration, then all of the diffracted waves would go through the objective lens, be focused at just the right point, and everything would be happy, okay? The unfortunate thing is that because of spherical aberration and its interrelationship with defocus, is as you go a particular distance away from the optic axis, the action of spherical aberration and defocus causes different phase shifts to occur, okay? This is captured in reciprocal space with this function here. This is actually about as ideal as it comes. And what this is plotting is reciprocal space distances, right, and the amount of shift that's happening from the aberration function. And so ideally, you would have your different diffracted waves superimposed at particular positions in reciprocal space, and these things would undergo changes due to the aberration, right? And if you had it working just right, there'd be no change at all. But instead, because of how this really complicated function looks, this one that's 1/2 pi, c sub s, lambda to the third, mu to the fourth, all of that, the way that this thing looks, this is essentially what we're plotting here, is an outcome of that particular function chosen for a particular defocus. Okay? Okay. Follow along. The next one I hope really solves all this. Okay. So, here's what these things look like as you vary. In particular, let's look at the defocus on the right. Okay? There's a series of different contrast transfer functions, this is called. That's one varying CS, as though I had a variable microscope, or two varying the defocus, as though I was just changing the objective lens current. And what this, the one on the right, is showing is it's showing that as I change the defocus, I have different changes in the phases of different diffracted waves depending on the defocus condition I use. So let's pick one. Let's say we're looking at silicon down the 100 zone axis, okay? If it has down the 100, there's going to be 200 diffracted beams, 220 diffracted beams, okay? Those are the ones that show up in 100. 200 is some distance away in reciprocal space, 1/2 angstrom, right? The distance in reciprocal space for 220 is 1/2.4-ish angstrom. I'm making these numbers up, but they're about right. And so essentially, these guys sit at some location along the x-axis here. In other words, this position here might be 200. That position there might be 220. That would mean that in the first diagram, the top one, this is undergo a pretty decent size phase shift of the 200, and it's going to almost truncate completely the presence of 220 in the image, okay? So these are the locations of a couple of different diffracted waves for mythical crystal A, all right? All right. What this says is it says that if I use a 200 kV microscope with CS of 1.0 and I use a minus 30 nanometer defocus, then I have this much phase shift away from perfect phase transfer at 1 for this beam, that much for that beam, and it turns out to be a minus phase shift for the third beam, okay? If instead I use minus 50 nanometers, I get much closer transfer of all three beams, right? If I use minus 70, the phase shifts are different between all three beams again. So what this is plotting out in a very simply descriptive fashion, I guess once you start to really look at them, is this idea that as we take the beam into the sample, the transmitted beam comes out, all the different diffracted beams come out. The objective lens phase shifts the different diffracted beams differently because of the combination of the spherical aberration and the defocus. This plot shows clearly what phase shifts occur for which diffracted beams, right? Because the diffracted beams exist at some length in reciprocal space, some distance away from the optic axis, and that distance determines how much phase shift they undergo from the spherical aberration at a particular defocus of the objective lens. Okay? So what this thing is doing, this contrast transfer function is doing, is it is varying the phase shifts for all of these different diffractive beams and showing you, for the defocus that you've chosen, what phase shifts occur. Okay? So my wave comes in, I've got my scattering potential, transmitted beam, a bunch of diffractive beams. I collect them all to form this phase image. If I had a perfect microscope, all I would need to know is the phase shifts in the diffractive beams. But the imperfection in my microscope causes there to be additional phase shifts that depend on defocus, and this plot shows you what those phase shifts are depending on the defocus that you're using. Yeah. From minimum contrast. So I hadn't said that, but how do you know what minus 30 and minus 50 and minus 70 is? That is all measured with respect to minimum contrast. Okay. So what you do when you use the microscope is the first thing you're ready, you get everything tilted, you're ready to go. You take your sample to minimum contrast because that's a definable condition. You hit a button that sets that equal to zero on your little display. Okay. And then you defocus a given amount so that you understand what the contrast transfer function is doing to all of the waves. And in particular, what you do is you defocus to this amount called the Schertzer defocus, if you can, right? Because that's the one that looks closest to this ideal transfer function. It's the one that gives a large range in reciprocal space over which there's very little additional phase shift from the spherical aberration effect. And so that means the image taken at Schertzer defocus is one that's most easily interpretable. The beautiful micrograph I showed earlier from Uli Domin of that aluminum sample, right, that looked like 111, right, where you had the white dots, right, that was perfectly taken at Schertzer defocus. But again, I mentioned that the white is where the atoms aren't. Well, you'll note that this is a minus phase shift, right? I hadn't really gotten into all that. I will in more detail. But you see, that's a minus phase shift. So that what that means is it's taking where the atoms are and giving you black on the other side. Okay, so that's Schertzer defocus. Okay? Okay, ponder this. Ponder this, and we'll do more of it next time. The contrast transfer function is an uber important idea in high resolution. Okay?